subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording another Storage Unpacked podcast, and I'm here with Martin. Been a while, Martin.
Well, it has been a bit. We're in summer. We don't normally record too much in a summer. At least we're having one this year.
Absolutely. Well, a recording or a summer?
A summer.
Yeah, both. It has been a while, hasn't it? We haven't recorded anything for a little while. However, I'm pleased to say that we're going to do something interesting today, and we're going to talk to Nikita Ivanov from GridGain about Apache Ignite and in-memory databases. So, Nikita, thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
How you doing, guys? Good morning or good afternoon? Well, it's good morning for me. It's good afternoon, I guess. Good evening for you guys.
It's almost an evening for us. Yep. But yes, you know, it's good to be able to chat and do it remotely and be able to manage it across our different time zones. So I'll tell you what, why don't we start off by setting the scene, Nikita, and just give us an introduction as to what Apache Ignite is, and then maybe then we can go off and talk about the whole in-memory database thing, because people might not really be 100% sure what Apache Ignite is in general.
All right, so typically, when somebody asks me this question, it could be either 2 minute or 2 hour conversation. So I'll go somewhere in the middle. You guys can stop me. Apache Ignite is typically, if you look at both Apache Ignite or GridGain.com websites, in the GridGain essentially is an enterprise version of the same software. We usually call it the memory computing platform. And word platform here is kind of important, because typically the idea of in memory computing literally started somewhere in the early 90s. And the idea was pretty simple. Hey, the memory is becoming, you know, more and more available. Why don't we, you know, instead of keeping stuff on the disk, on the tape, why don't we, you know, start keeping data in RAM? Wouldn't that be nice, right? RAM is faster. It's faster and faster and faster than disk. The gap is kind of, you know, growing. Although lately with, you know, NVMe and the PCIe 4, it's, I think, gap is kind of closing a little bit. But nonetheless, memories was still basically the king in terms of performance. There was obviously, from a day one, there was the big difference between, you know, traditional storage mediums and RAM. RAM is volatile, right? You unplug the computer, it's gone. So there's a many, many different ways to solve that. And essentially, when it comes to in-memory computing software, initially that was all about solving that particular problem. How can I, you know, put something in RAM, and when it's all unplugged, I don't lose it somehow? So you copy it multiple. So that's actually one of the solutions to this problem was the realization that we need to have more than one computer in a cluster so that we can actually copy this data so that one crashes or has some outages, we don't lose the data, for example. Another, you know, interesting aspect is that, you know, in-memory computing, because of that reason, but also because of another reason, in-memory computing was one of the first distributed systems, massively distributed systems in existence. You know, and if you remember, you know, early, mid-90s, the RAM was, on a single computer, what we're looking about, maybe a megabyte per workstation per server, and it was not enough because the storage was obviously much bigger. So back in those days, we realized that we need to string together multiple computers to really have any kind of, you know, hopeful capacity that's useful. So these two kind of, you know, disjoint trends, you know, quest for capacity and quest for reliability when the memory is volatile, led to this situation where in-memory computing became really one of the most advanced distributed systems because they just had to be. And so over the years, it's kind of developed. And, you know, today, the reason we're talking about in-memory computing platform, not storage, not database specifically, but the platform, is because it really encompasses a lot of different use cases. It's obviously in-memory storage of data. It's partitioned storage in memory. It's a streaming. It's machine learning. It's complex event processing. It's, you know, traditional SQL in memory. So essentially, computations, MPP type of processing also. So basically, anything you can do with the data stored in RAM is what really the platforms like Ignite allow you to do. And one more comment before we dive in.
Yeah, sure.
Sometimes when I say this kind of, you know, words, people kind of get confused. You know, why is it so different, right? Who cares where it's stored, right? RAM, disk, tape, flash, it's all kind of, you know. You know, for anybody who is, you know, doubled in storage, even, you know, rudimentarily, understand that, you know, the RAM is bi-addressable. The economics of getting a single byte out of the RAM is very, very different from getting a single byte out of any block-level device, which is today, you know, everything from tape to drives to flash to, you know, Intel Optane, almost everything else. You know, even if you take the, you know, the fastest PCIe 4 NVMe drive, it's still going to be a black label device. So the economics of getting the 1 byte back to you is very different. In memory, it's a pointer arithmetic. You just switch to your pointer and you get the same byte at the RAM. On any other device, no matter how close it gets to the RAM speed, you are essentially getting a block, you know, sometimes in a pretty large block of data, and you only get, you know, a small byte out of it. So economics is different. And that's, you know, fundamentally where the, you know, all opportunity for optimizations comes around. You know, if you can optimize for this economics, you can really retune your algorithm, sometimes completely rebuild the algorithms. How do you work with the data? Because again, the economics of getting a single byte is very different. And okay. Vice versa, by the way, you know, obviously block level access is more efficient on the larger volumes.
Okay. So you've introduced like, I think like about 10 or 15 different topics there all in one little short segment. And I think there's some really key bits to go back and focus on. So anybody who's a storage person will definitely be used to the idea of a block device versus you know, memory and load store versus read and write at a block level. And I think that is a really important factor, because as we try to understand when we get to it a bit further on, understanding the difference about how you manipulate data that you typically would have thought was on disk, and you have to understand how you make that work compared to having it in memory, I think becomes really important. And we'll touch on the Optane side of things there. But I was really fascinated to think that a lot of this has come from that need, or has driven the need to have distributed systems, which is really interesting, because we sort of see distributed systems coming back in different scenarios these days, used for maybe object storage or other things, or even say Kubernetes. So you're sort of implying that a lot of stuff may have already been pre-done in this area in terms of distributed systems to support this type of workload.
Yes, it's a very surprising, you know, for anybody, well, for us, you know, for people who is in the field, it's very kind of, you know, closed in, you know, small community. But for anybody from outside, it sounds almost, you know, ridiculous at some point. How in-memory computing is related to distribution? You grab people on the street and ask, hey, what do you think about in-memory computing? He'll tell you, hey, perfect. I'll just move data from disk to memory. Even, you know, my grandma would know it's faster. And that's the end of the story, right? Mm-hmm. And surprisingly, the in-memory aspect really become almost secondary, because it's such already a developed an approach or technology. Distribution is where the parallelization of a processing and the parallelization of a data storage is what the for kind of, you know, a real, you know, money is in right now in terms of a memory computing system. Because again, it's interesting that just by storing data in RAM, if that's the only thing you're going to do, is going to buy you much. And today we're talking about, what, you know, tens of hundreds of terabytes of typical payloads and like intraday workloads and bigger financial institutions. There's no computer you can buy where you can stuff up, you know, 100 terabyte of RAM. And if you can do something like this in a custom, you know, custom setup, you're going to choke on any other component in the system, on the bus, on the CPU, and everywhere else. So you end up needing a distribution. And, you know, we've seen our, you know, users of Ignite, you know, go from, you know, 5-10 nodes all the way to hundreds upon hundreds of nodes in the clusters.
Right.
And to really gain this parallelization of storage in both processing, in memory computing, and like, for example, let's consider SQL databases. Why SQL databases, you know, are still, you know, left out in the Stone Age when it comes to distribution? Because it was never designed for it. SQL was never designed for distribution. It's very hard to parallelize SQL through a very known, you know, joint explosion problems. So literally, SQL as in SQL algebra was never designed for parallelization. And, you know, you've seen many, many different tries of solving this on the hardware level, on the software level. It doesn't work. It's because of mathematics. And in memory computing, as a corollary to this, was forced to do from a day one, from early 90s. And I was involved with it since late 90s. From early days of it, it was forced to do something in parallel on multiple computers. And therefore, today, it's one of the most advanced systems in the world.
Okay. Martin, just bringing you into that discussion. I mean, you know, you look at the way that we would normally sort of typically think about things like protected data in an environment and distribution and replicas and all those other things that you might do to protect your data when you're at scale. It's fascinating to think that a lot of the technologies that we're looking at now are already there, but actually they could actually go a bit further than we are today and deliver something that could be really, really challenging as we start to see some of those new media come along.
Yeah, certainly see new media comes along. I mean, I think it's really interesting when we start talking about in-memory systems, because I think, as Nikita points out, was talking about, a lot of people just think, well, I just load my whole, all my data into my memory and then it'll be super fast. But we're talking about much, much, much larger data sets. I mean, we're talking, often when you're talking to some enterprises, they think a terabyte is a big database. But for a lot of people, it is. But this isn't what these systems are designed to deal with at all. And so, and the parallelization of the systems, as Nikita said, I mean, the MPP, the parallel processing has been around for quite some time. We're now seeing it beginning to mature or become much more useful in the general enterprise as well.
So can we sort of touch on what sort of structures and how Ignite would support different types of data models? Because you've obviously highlighted the fact that SQL is not particularly appropriate to scale in a distributed model. I would imagine things like key value systems probably are, because we already see key value systems out there elsewhere. And, you know, key value in some form or other has been around for a long time. So what can we expect from the Ignite platform in terms of different data structures and types?
So, yes. Ignite is fundamentally, it's a what I've called a kind of polyglot in terms of the data structure it supports. So, the fundamental layer on which everything is based is a key value, because again, it is most conducive to distribution. It's easy to replicate it, easy to keep track, it's easy to transact on and whatnot. On top of the basic key value, and there is a clear key value APIs if you needed one, we also support a SQL 99. So you can obviously use SQL. Again, if you just want to do ad hoc SQL on the absolutely not optimized storage, like not using any star schema, for example, then obviously we're not gonna change the laws of physics. You're gonna be as slow or as effective as SQL allows us to do. And we face exactly the same problem like everybody else. If you want to join, you know, terabytes of tables, you know, you end up with, you know, we try to do some streaming in terms of the processing SQL, but There is no escaping laws of physics and mathematics when it comes to it. Now, if you use something like star schema, where you can basically do the you know, facts and dimensions, like you would do in typical, you know, data warehousing, then we can take advantage of that, and then, you know, your joins become very effective. But nonetheless, it's just, now it's basically down to the optimization of a SQL schema. So we have key value, we have a SQL 99 access, if you like, and by the way, we're actually very proud of this because we're shipping the DBC drivers, so you can literally look at Ignite as a database if you want to. Many customers actually like it. We also have a streaming APIs, and we also had a file system API on top of the same key value. So the same key value set, data set, can be viewed as a key value data set, and that's what typically referred to as a data grid, where you literally have a key value access. You can view it as the same data set, you can view as a SQL 99. Kind of, it's almost like a view on the same data. You can also view it the same way as a file system, as a POSIX file system.
Okay, so how many nodes would you typically build out then if you're building out resiliency for any of those solutions? You know, are we talking, you know, minimum, say, 3-5, or do people typically deploy dozens? I mean, what's the sort of scalability of this?
Yeah, so let me put this way. We've tested, independently, by the way, up to several thousand, I think 2,500 nodes in a cluster, in a fully transactional topology. Now, I do not recommend that, because managing 2,000 nodes is literally, it's a full-time job for a team of people. Mm-hmm. That's just not what I recommend at all. I think a typical sweet spot is anywhere between like 8 and 64 nodes is where, you know, in today's world, you can get a pretty decent hardware, whether it's your, you know, in-house stuff or you can rent on the cloud. And that's from a manageability standpoint, it's something that is manageable and observable, that something that can actually deliver a lot of value.
And would customers typically deploy a single application within that, or would they deploy multiple ones? So, for instance, you said you can support SQL 99 and you can support like a file system solution. Would you see them do both of those in there? Would you typically dedicate a cluster to one type of application?
Again, it depends on application. Generally, I would advocate for kind of federated cluster approach, where you have a cluster per application. Application is big enough. Let's say it's a trading system or portfolio management. Yes, obviously, you need to have a dedicated cluster to that from a security standpoint, from data security, access security, testability, and whatnot. So I would not recommend doing a multi-application, multi-tenancy for kind of high-risk applications. If it's a small apps, some reporting, some whatnot, yeah, you can obviously run as many apps as you like.
Yeah, okay.
So it's very specific. I don't think there's a technological difference here. It's more kind of a, what do you guys really do with this?
I guess so. And I think that's the reason why I was asking the question, because if you're going to start using it in a big way, then typically if you're having to build out a distributed system every time you want to deploy the technology, there's this level of practicality to everybody having their own individual distributed system for every application. You know, it would make no sense to say when you've got 1,000 databases to have everyone having their own scale out set
right,
of nodes.
Right.
So there's going to be some, I guess, some trade-off, but I also appreciate that in an expensive trading system, you would definitely want to dedicate that for
Yeah, and look, people don't really use, that's a bit of a difference between, traditional databases and something like Ignite a Grid Gain. People don't really use that for kind of plain vanilla small use cases. It's still a fairly expensive from in terms of, well, you got to have hardware to run it on. The developer resources are fairly high-end. People who understand the memory computing, who understand principles of distributed processing, those are not the cheap resources for you. So generally, what we're finding is that take a look at MemSQL and us. We know each other. By the way, two companies have the founders with name Nikita. So it's always fun. But if you look at MemSQL, for example, they used a lot in kind of the small departmental replacement for SQL, right? And they're kind of moving to analyticals right now. But in the past, we've seen them quite a lot. Where Ignite and Grid Gain comes in as kind of this, hey, we have one trading system, we have one portfolio optimization, or one book of record system. That's going to be based on Ignite and a Grid Gain because it requires all this performance and everything else. But, and then there's five or seven smaller apps around us that have localized MemSQL databases. Very few people will actually use something like Ignite for kind of localized, 10-user app within your organization. It's just, overkill. But for a mission-critical apps, we have a pretty strong, look, we're a small startup. We're still a small startup. We're over 100 people company. Look at our customer base. We have who's in the business, and most critical systems today running on what we do. It's less about us as a company, whatnot. It's just more about where the technology is really used.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, Martin, just bringing you back into that discussion there. I guess I was just trying to understand the scenario because, in an environment where you're looking at about where you target this sort of requirement, then clearly there are going to be scenarios where, for example, thinking off the top of my head, you can pretty much clearly see something like a trading application or something where you need super low latency in order to achieve what you're doing. Absolutely, you would want to dedicate an entire environment for this. But actually, I think there would be a certain qualification process because you're investing in a lot of technology and a lot of skills in order to see the difference between a traditional database and what the implications you're using in memory might be.
Well, yeah, you're not going to deploy it for your warehouse application. At least I don't think you are. If you're not too worried about high performance, low latency, this isn't a technology for that. I was just looking at the Ignite webpage or the Ignite facts. Yeah, you probably could do that, but it'd be a very expensive way of doing it. So I'm kind of intrigued to see. So we talk about trading. What new applications are coming along where we think that we're really going to see this start to fly, not just the low latency trading floor applications. We always talk about those, but there are many other low latency applications which would be interesting, which would be interested in something like Ignite.
Okay. Sorry, Nikita, I didn't want to interrupt there, but I just wanted to qualify that question or at least your answer before you start. And that's just as to whether, when we look across the market, we've seen certain physical attempts at the lower storage level to improve performance and lower latency for database applications. And there's obviously an increasing demand in performance. And I just wonder whether a lot of customers are looking at the in-memory solution as a way to fix the problems that they simply couldn't solve by using faster technology, you know, like faster NVMe or, you know, plug-in devices or other things like that.
Yeah. Actually, let me just come back to what just Martin said just a few moments ago. If we would have this conversation like 10 to 15 years ago, and if you ask me, Nikita, what are the customers' use cases? I would say Wall Street, London, that's it. That's where it's all originated. I remember my time in the late 90s, in the beginning of 2000s, you know, memory computing was literally a talk on the Wall Street and the financial applications only. There's no other use cases for that, literally, for the need. Today, it's actually less than half of our business. You know, and we've seen it everywhere from drug discovery to mobile backends to our obviously finance and whatnot and payments and list goes on and on and on. We've seen manufacturing, we've seen AI, you know, we just released this whole, you know, in-memory machine learning capability. So I always give this example, and if you heard my talks in the conference, I always give it, you know, literally more than 15 years ago when Ignite and Gridgain was just starting out, we had a customer who came back to us. It's a simple app that basically, it's a, literally a single workstation with database. It's a financial reporting. You type in whatever reporting parameters you need, like in the last month, last year, a few more things, click button. And this thing goes in SQL database, goes about 30 seconds. 30 seconds, it spits out the big report with the charts and everything else. And the guys told us, hey, can we, like, we want to put it on the web. Nobody's going to wait half a minute when you press a button. Can we, like, make it 3 seconds? Something like, you know, tangible. Now, think about it. How do you make something 10 times faster? From 30 seconds to 3. It was absolutely benign app. It's written in SQL. It was written, actually, as a matter of fact, in Java. It was a Microsoft SQL database. It's as benign as possible. It just takes that time. It just goes and crunches, goes back and crunches, analyzes, you know, creates some, you know, intermediate tables, views, and does it all. It takes 30 seconds. We look at everything. We looked at, like, can we buy a faster computer? Can we write with assembly? No, it's ridiculous. Okay, we looked at everything possible. And the only solution we could come up, hey, can we move this half a terabyte data set in RAM and parallelize this execution over, like, 6 boxes? And we got it, actually, like, really by the week of effort, more than that. We got it to about 2.5 seconds.
Right.
That was, you know, for me, it was an absolutely eye-opening experience. You don't have to be DOD or big Wall Street firm or some kind of government or military stuff to really have a need for something like this. It can be very simple, benign app going from 30 seconds to 3. And that jump is literally impossible, physically impossible, unless you basically do first in-memory, second, you do parallelization of it on distribution. Right. So that's basically kind of, you know, certainly an anecdotal comment to the Martin's point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I mean that in itself is interesting because I see two bits to that. First of all, you know, the fact that you're highlighting that the type of data profile of something that might need an in-memory solution might be something where you're seeing continuous repeated I/O, that the latency of going out to an external device and rereading blocks of data rather than bytes of data amplifies the challenge of actually trying to process data where the latency might be in milliseconds and not in nanoseconds when it's from DRAM. And I think the other side of it is the fact that it sounds to me like a lot of the applications might be very suitable to large data sets because of both the distribution, but also because of the model of being able to actually run that in memory effectively. It sounds to me like you see more benefit on large data sets from what you're describing.
Yeah, in today's world, I would say if you have a small data sets, and a prime example for that would be Monte Carlo simulations. You know, if you look in the financials, 10 years ago, Monte Carlo simulation was predominantly run on distributed systems like Ignite. Today, it's almost 100% domain of GPUs because GPUs are just much, much more performant. It's basically MPP on the card. If you have something that can fit into the whatever 8, 16 gigs of traditional, you know, 32 gigs of GPU RAM, which is DDR6, by the way, and the typical NVIDIA would have, you know, several thousand cores, it's literally, if you can fit all of that, and if you were kind of, you know, okay with the more numerical type of processing, GPU is a king. The minute you have more than 8 or 16 gig of data payload, which typically your enterprise customers would have, GPU is out of window because you're going to spend more time, you know, moving data from low RAM to the faster RAM. And then you need to have something like just, you know, parallelization. Remember in the very beginning I told you that the in-memory aspect of it is becoming almost secondary to distribution. That's precisely because of the, you know, you can only feed so much into the a single computer or a single card in this for that for in the GPU case. The minute it doesn't fit, you actually now in a world of distribution, and the complexity, you know, has a step function here. It's a completely different world when you have one computer. You don't really care about anything in terms of the distribution and transactionality and data consistency and all of this, you know, a world. The minute you have more than one, two or more, you're in a completely different universe.
This is pushing us a very interesting discussion area, because now if we're trying to work out how we compare Ignite to other platforms and other solutions in the market, and you already mentioned it, MemSQL, but you know, we don't want to beat up on the competitors particularly, but it sounds to me like, you know, this isn't about anything else other than those particular pieces of technology that relate to the distribution and so on. So what would you highlight as the key factors if you were trying to determine what is going to highlight one solution being better than another? I mean, the distribution is obviously the big one you've just mentioned.
Let me actually rephrase your question a little bit, if you allow me.
Absolutely. Yeah, go for it.
What I would, you know, would be interesting as a listener to this is, what are the, you know, Achilles heel of this? Because it cannot be so rosy. It cannot be all this. Because obviously, you know, in-memory computing today is still is something that is fairly unknown. It pains me to say that, because I've spent, you know, a good portion of my professional life dealing with it and developing it. It's still considered to be this kind of, you know, cutting edge, a little bit academic, a little bit of scientific, like a little bit for nerds, only used like by super high performance apps or something like this. The biggest Achilles heel of this technology is its complexity.
Okay.
Flat out. If I could somehow magically remove one thing from all of this, it's complexity. Unfortunately, this jump from block-level device to byte addressability to this complex distribution create this enormous perception, which is still true to a large degree, that it requires you can't just take an average developer off the street and let him basically deal with this. Like you would do with SQL databases, you know. I'm not saying anything negatively here, but I'm saying that, you know, it's a very well-defined, very well trained, you know, a group of engineers who can deal with the SQL optimization and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, in-memory is still a very arcane area. You need to have a top-notch people who actually know the stuff. And you can get one or two, but if your project requires 20 of those, you're in trouble.
Right.
So complexity is overriding problem within memory computing. Complexity, complexity, complexity. And that's why you don't see it as frequently or as often. It's only basically we see it as a kind of, you know, a desperation move for a lot of customers. It's basically like, oh my God, the only option I have is in memory computing. I have to dive into it. So it sounds a little bit comical and funny, but it's, by and large, I think it's still true. Yeah, in Silicon Valley, you know, we live in this little bit of a bubble, and everybody's trying left and right new things. It's kind of, you know, but you know, you move for 2 hours from Silicon Valley, you're having a different world, even in California and Americas, and there's a lot of resistance to this complexity. And complexity means cost, because I have to hire people, I have to do something, timing and whatnot.
And Martin, you know, token end user here as you are, so. You know, you're working in a large environment where you're handling large amounts of data. You know, does this sort of technology leap out at you and you think, oh, I can see applications where perhaps this would actually be beneficial to us?
I can see where we would use it, but I can also see, as Nikita says, I mean, there would getting hold of the skills and the right developers to actually work on this and create the applications and the use cases. Well, no, we'd have the use cases, but getting developers to work on the applications We find it in all kinds of areas. It's not just within in-memory databases. As soon as you start going to parallel type environments, distributed environments, whether it's distributed storage, certainly outside of the main academic centres, you're going to struggle to find people. And then even trying to pull academics out of academic developers out of academia and actually make them try and do a real job, that's pretty tough as well. So, yeah, I would agree with Nikita. It's probably one of these in which we've seen a low level of take-up of all kinds of really useful technologies. There's just not the people to do it.
Okay. Does that mean, Nikita, that we should be expecting that Ignite and the whole project should be moving the development of these type of solutions into a position where they are becoming more attractive for people to adopt without having high levels of skills?
Obviously, yes. You know, if you guys can look at the, who is ever interested can look at the track of Ignite 3.0, it's right there in the community. We started basically to address some of these issues. But it's obviously not a new problem. I didn't just say something that's, you know, fascinatingly new and fresh. We've been seeing this for years, and if not decade by now. It's hard to fundamentally fix this because it's rooted in this in a very basic idea that you have to become very comfortable with the parallelization or parallel processing or distribution in general. And that's a hard problem for many engineers to grapple because on a daily basis they don't involve in this or it's very hidden from them. Here you really, really have to get comfortable with a programming your system in distributed fashion. Otherwise, you're not getting any benefits out of it. You get some, you know, but look, I always keep saying, you know, when I talk to customers, if you need, you know, two times faster, three times faster, don't even look at us. Do whatever you want to do. Buy faster storage, faster computers, hire better engineers. If you're looking at 10 to 100 times faster, well, then talk to us. Because in order to make a jump of order of magnitude, you cannot buy anything. You cannot hire anybody. You need to have a different approach. And that's where something like igniting great gain in memory, computing, and distribution can really help. We've seen these examples. We've seen, you know, performance increases, you know, in several orders of magnitude, specifically when the original system was not really well designed and optimized. But at the very least, if you do it right, you should see at least 10x performance increase for your major operations and data. And for that, yeah, talk to us. But anything beyond that, two times faster, three times faster, I'm not really interested.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if people wanted to try this out, though, then is that creating still a real barrier to entry for people just to say, let's go off and try this ourselves and see what we think? You know, how easy would it be if you have to have all of these skills? Because it becomes a bit of a challenge then between, do I really want to engage with somebody? Do I want to try it out myself? You know, the current way that we tend to do a lot of deployment of technology is, well, let's just give a few guys in the corner some time, let them go and try it out themselves, install it, see how it works, and then let's come back and work out what we do. How adaptable is the technology to that sort of approach?
I think, you know, the fact that it's part of the Apache Software Foundation, it's open source, no strings attached, you know, no commercial entity, you know, holding your hand by the time clock, is perfect for that. And again, you're absolutely right. I would say 99% of our commercial customers start exactly like that. And I almost assume that 100% of our Ignite users, which is tens of thousands around the world, start exactly the same way. Maybe I was like overly pessimistic about the complexity. Maybe I shouldn't sound like this, but you know, I tend to sound a little bit kind of, you know, black and white so often. Obviously, for example, if you compare us to Redis, which is another, mm-hmm. you know, a very well-known in-memory system.
We've chatted to the guys from Redis.
They're much simpler in terms of what they support, but they're dramatically simpler to use. And there is no question that for every person who knows, for every 100 people who know how to use Redis, there's only one who knows how to use Ignite. It's much more widespread.
I have a Raspberry Pi cluster sitting in that direction, which is running Redis at the moment. You know,
that's a testament that, you know, there is a different approach where you provide a much narrower, simpler functional use case, but with that translates in a much easier usage model, much easier adoption. Yeah, you're not going to get anything like 10x performance with Redis, but it was never designed for it. It was designed for a different use case, and it's beautiful. I love the product, by the way. I love the company. And that's what I'm saying, that, you know, I don't think we have some kind of, you know, a magical solution we eventually will arrive to, like, which will make us, you know, as easy to use, as digestible as Redis. I always, you know, given this kind of, you know, kind of cheesy comparison that, you know, Redis is literally a Hyundai or Honda cars in the market, and we are trying to come up with the Ferrari engines. Both are fine, you know, technologies, you know, nothing better. It's just a different, you know, different targets. You know, there's a lot more people that need Hondas and Hyundais to drive back and forth from work. There's quite a few people that still require a Ferrari to run on track.
Yeah. But bringing Martin in there. It's a classic thing, Martin, isn't it? You know, that, you know, there's never going to be one technology that fits something, but there is always going to be a spectrum of different technologies. And you really do have to spend a lot of time understanding the different nuances and features in the target market and the specific, I guess, benefits of each of these different technologies before you decide which to adopt.
Well, everybody will always look for the one technology to fix all their problems. We've seen it in storage, we see it in databases, we see it all over the place. I mean, and if you talk to some of the big enterprise vendors, they'll have a product which will fix all your problems. But you're right, we know that's not the case. Even a large enterprise, we're still trying to look for the smallest product set we can get away with. At the moment, if we look at in-memory or even NoSQL, there's a plethora of products. And that's one of the problems we're seeing, is we're seeing so many different products and so many different APIs coming through. I think Ignite's interesting because if you're, from a developer point of view, if you know how Redis works, you can use Ignite with a Redis client, so you can start to use it. So that's where I think it will get interesting to see. If we start seeing better ways of accessing these, whether it's an in-memory database or it's a different type of database. So from a developer point of view, at one level, you're not quite so worried about it. You don't have to be an expert on everything.
Mm, okay. So as we sort of get towards, I guess, the end of our time, I just wanted to touch on new media, because I think this is an interesting area. You know, if you look back to the 90s, as you were talking about, Nikita, we pretty much, apart from a few bits of bubble memory and various other things, we pretty much had DRAM, super, 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 super fast at the very top here, and disk, which looked absolutely archaic by comparison. You know, and over the years, we've added SSD in there, which has given a bit of an improvement. But clearly, the technology that we're starting to see really coming into this market are things like Optane, 3D XPoint, MRAM, which are not necessarily faster block devices, but give us that ability to use byte addressability. And they changed the model because they also had the persistence side of that to it. So how do you see that changing the market for the sort of technology you're developing?
I'm smiling for those
who nobody can see you on the we're only podcasting, we don't record videos. Yeah. So yeah,
smiling on the radio, right?
Tell everybody you're smiling.
The reason I'm smiling is because we were involved with NVRAM for the last 7 years, working with the Micron before then Intel, and then now they all separate. And we actually worked with in a non-volatile DRAM where it was just a stick with the battery and the controller.
Yeah.
If you remember the early versions of the VRAM, it was literally just the DRAM, the battery, and the controller. And it just was, it was basically copying, you know, using the battery to copy it from main RAM to this. Anyways, originally I was very excited because obviously it was solving the major problem of, you know, a volatility of a RAM. So your traditional RAM goes out when your power goes out. And there's a lot of software to kind of, you know, overcome this issue and overhead naturally associated with it. So I thought, well, beautiful. You know, if the RAM itself becomes centrally non-volatile, we don't need to have all of this. And that was a naive thinking. And at this point, you know, many, many years later, it's still, you know, Intel Optane is the latest iteration of that. It's actually an interesting hardware story because it's literally, I think, the first, I think, different hardware architecture, silicon architecture, in the last like 50 years for a storage product, which is in itself very, very remarkable. But from a software perspective, it's still a very muddy story. What we kind of learn is that, think about this, the whole generation of several generation of engineers came up with grew up with the assumption that when you unplug the power, you get a clean slate. You reboot your computer, you start from scratch. There's a lot of assumptions built into it. When you think a little bit deeper, you realize how ingrained that's almost a religion to us, that you can wipe out the entire computer by unplugging it and start from clean. So whatever crash you had, whatever error you had, you can always do that. all of a sudden, there is now a technology that tells you, no, you crashed, you plug and plug, and still there. Wonderful. What do I do with this crash? How do I mark it? How do I uncrash it? How do I actually clean this if I need to clean this? So where's my BIOS support? Where's my operating system support? How all drivers will behave now? And all of a sudden, we realize there's a massive can of worms that is in a cross industry from a BIOS, from a chipset, all the way to operating system to everything else. And that's why NVRAM is where it is today, which is predominantly just a block level interface on top of it. Even Optane, which is the level 4 is the block byte addressable level, right? That just basically has no practicality at this point.
Yeah, I guess I'd look at it and think that whole idea of being able to wipe the slate clean actually is quite useful. So if somebody says to you, here's a node that we lost state on or it died or something, if you just get told you've got to start from scratch, just rebuild the whole data set back onto that node in whatever format you're using, that's one thing. If somebody tells you some of that data might be consistent, some of it might not be, we don't really know how long we were out, so we don't know how long our data is out of date. So it might be out of date by a second, a minute, an hour, a day. Now you've got a real sort of consistency check to do across all that data to bring it back.
Exactly.
So is that actually bringing in a bigger problem than the problem we had previously?
Precisely.
That seems to be the biggest challenge.
It's actually, you'll be surprised. I guarantee to you that even for a lot of our silicon engineers who basically developed this memory, this realization came as a big surprise. So I remember those conversations for years having with some people from Micron and Intel and everybody else that, yeah, it's wonderful. It's a silver bullet. That's it. The biggest problem with the RAM is volatility. We solve volatility, we're golden. This is it. This is the end. This is the beginning of the new era. And then it was like about a couple of years, a time frame where everybody was like, holy crap. Mm. It's not that simple. What do we do with this and that and that and that and that? And, everybody just realized, yeah, we can find some specific use case like very non-volatile caching. We can allocate certain region of RAM that, we're going to use as a quick reboot cache. But it's such an arcane, specific, small use case that doesn't even remotely warrant all this new development, once in a century, new silicon architecture. Yeah. So I think, look, this is a hot topic for me because I've spent so much time and it's at this point for me, it's a flaming disaster in terms of the marketing and the market go-to-market strategy from Intel or anybody else. Because all we've got is the new PCIe devices. Fine. Jesus, who cares? I mean, as a matter of fact, if you look at the PCIe 4 and NVMe, it's already at the speed of RAM. It's pretty much the same as DDR4, give it a take.
Yeah.
Right? So the obvious problem, if you look at this whole block level device, is that if you need to read the body, go through what? A system call, a driver, a seek time, a bus, and then all the way back through the same sequence of calls versus a simple point arithmetic. That's where the bulk of the delay is. That's where your nanoseconds versus microseconds and sometimes milliseconds. And, until we come up with, and as a matter of fact, and I believe at this point, it's the advancement of non-volatile RAM has nothing to do with Intel. Hardware is done. It's between chipset, BIOS, operating system, drivers. So whenever you can buy the next laptop with a full support for non-volatile RAM, fully integrated with the operating system and it's in the basic applications, then we're talking about something.
Okay, let's park that one to another discussion in that case. Martin, anything else to add on that? I mean, bearing in mind, we all like the idea of persistent memory. It seems to be a popular topic these days.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very popular topic. But I thought it was really interesting. I hadn't really thought so deeply about it, about all the other problems it brings. Because, you just perceive you can, if it crashes, you just bring it back up again. It's fine. Your data's still in memory. You don't have any problems. And, absolutely. We fixed a hardware problem. Now the software needs to catch up. And, I think that's a very interesting topic for a future conversation, Chris.
Absolutely. But unfortunately for now, we seem to have planned for a huge amount of time. And I'm sure we could talk for hours, but I think perhaps we should call it a day here and point people in the right direction to understand where they can go learn about GridGain and Apache Ignite. Perhaps, Nikita, you can do that, and then we'll plan to come back and dig deeper next time into some of these challenges. So where can people go and find out a bit more?
Sure. The best thing to look at is Apache Ignite. And don't look at the website. Just go to Google and say Apache Ignite. And you're going to find it right away. It's open source. It's Apache license. Plenty of example of implementation. Despite the fact that I said it's pretty complicated stuff, you can start pretty quickly and pretty effectively. So go there. And from there, you can find all your ways around.
Fantastic. Well, Nikita, thank you very much for joining us this time. It's been really interesting. I think we've given ourselves a few future topics to talk about as well. So I appreciate your time and look forward to catching up. Talk to you in the future.
Thanks a lot, guys.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.